Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovesh, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Ecological economics is about finding ways to achieve environmental and social justice in our sustainability transitions. However, justice is a fragile and ambiguous concept, and it is in the eye of the beholder where it gains meaning. Colonialism did not end with previously colonized countries gaining their freedom. It lives on in our global culture, economy, social processes, and in the perception of self-worth in all of us. Science is no exception. Knowledge production is still vastly biased towards Western, masculine, often Cartesian values. As transformation is only likely to be successful if we transcend currently dominant paradigms, decolonizing knowledge production is key not only in terms of justice, but also in terms of finding adequate solutions. Today, our guest Brototi Roy will shed light on why. Brototi is an ecological economist and political ecologist. She's a postdoctoral researcher based joint at the Autonomous University of Barcelona and Central European University. She's board member of the International Society for Ecological Economics and co-founder of the Degrowth India Initiative. She's also the co-director of Research and Degrowth, the Barcelona-based group on degrowth. Her research focuses primarily on environmental justice, degrowth, and decolonization. Welcome, Brototi.
Thank you so much for having me here today. I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Thank you for being with us. In the introduction, I said that we need to decolonize our knowledge production, not only to achieve justice, but also to build on knowledge that kind of transcends our dominant narratives. I would first like to deconstruct these claims and have a look at them one by one and move maybe from the problems towards potential solutions. First, what is wrong with our current ways of producing knowledge?
Mm-hmm. So the thing about the ways in which we produce and understand knowledge is that if you look at university syllabuses, if you look at what are the textbooks we are referring and reading to, you often see that the kind of people we are citing, the kind of knowledges that we give value to, come from a very particular dominant set of or profiles of authors. So you would see most of the textbook that we're reading, and I will of course talk only specifically for my field. So I have a background in economics, and now I work more with ecological economics and political ecology. And even in these fields, we see that the kind of authors that we are reading or the textbooks that we are reading have been either in Europe, either published in Europe or North America primarily, often by people who sit in these big universities. The presses are global international presses, be it like the Oxford University's press, California press, big presses, you know? And so then the question comes, who are the people who get access to write the kind of books? Where do they come from? And if we understand what goes into producing these books or what goes into producing these articles published in these big journals, then we start to see the biases of knowledge production. So to put it more simply, what are the claims or what are the inherent biases of what we are reading? To give a small example of economics, for example, all the textbooks that I have read back in India and now in Europe come from either Europe or US. They have certain understanding of what exactly or who exactly is a rational human being. this is the basic assumption of economics. No rational human being wants to maximize profit. But this is not true for all the cases. But what we see and what we hear is just this one dominant narrative, and everything else gets clubbed into alternatives happening somewhere in the majority world, but doesn't really explain what is happening in the world. So this is the problem with the coloniality of knowledge, or this is the problem when we sideline or invisibilize all the different ways in which economics works, all the different ways in which people relate to each other, to society and to environment, but only focus on a very monetary, very profit, benefit, loss, cost kind of narrative, you know? So this is one problem of who is producing knowledge. And the second thing is, then when you read these books or when you look at the people producing, then that means a majority of the population don't find representation. So there were some exercises being done recently in trying to diversify the field of economics and asking school children, who do you see when you think of an economist? And you would always find in the narrative, like somebody who's wearing a very proper suit and is, you know, like middle class, predominantly white male. So then that means somehow everybody else who doesn't fit into that profile don't recognize themselves as feeling that they have the authority or they have the power to decide something about how the world works. So these, I would say, are the two main problems of the way in which knowledge is being produced right now.
Can we also put the word decolonization into context? I have heard many arguing that this is also a term that has been kind of co-opted and no longer has the message it is supposed to have. So what does decolonization mean to you?
So for me, decolonization is more than just making small changes in a syllabus. Decolonization needs to be taken into the context of the colonized subjects. So how exactly was certain forms of knowledge production given predominance over the others? What went into that? For example, if you look at, particularly in the case of US and Canada, if you look at where all the universities are built, all of them, most of them were built on lands which used to be indigenous land. So there is this physical reality of what went into removing people from their lands, removing people from their ways of life, and setting up these big institutions which now produce knowledge. So when you talk about decolonization, and there is this very nice article called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor, this basically says that when you talk about decolonization, it doesn't mean you add certain references here and there, but you completely forget what went into these institutions. When you talk about decolonization of knowledge, not only should you try to understand and engage more with other forms of knowledge production, but also engage more with the people who were removed when this whole process of setting up this current knowledge paradigm took place. So decolonization of knowledge in that sense would mean that you're opening your classrooms and you're opening your discussions to marginalized communities. Decolonization would mean then to be aware of why are there certain people in the room and not the others? What are the systemic and structural reasons why they are not there? And how can we include them and make sure that there is a conversation which is happening both ways and not, for example, just going and extracting knowledge from them again and doing the same kind of, okay, now suddenly decolonization has become such a hot topic, so we're just going to go to a community, take knowledge, come back and write about them again without giving them a place in the table. So I think that for me is what exactly I understand by decolonization of knowledge.
And how is this related to justice?
So if you think of justice as socio-ecological equity, as ensuring that all the voices are heard equally, then this becomes very important because from my background in political ecology, we say that everything which is ecological is politics and everything which is politics is ecological. in the sense that you cannot do politics in isolation. So if politics happens in society, which is embedded in the environment, then everything, every kind of political decisions that you're making are also ecological decisions. And so when you're making these decisions, if you only make these decisions with certain people or certain sections of the society and remove the rest of them, then it is not just anymore, you know? So if only certain people get to decide what they feel is justice for everybody else, then they are again taking the voice away, invisibilizing, sidelining other forms of, other ways of understanding what means justice. And justice in that sense also needs to be very contextualized. And this is where these ideas of traditional ecological knowledge, different ways of understanding what is good, what is bad, what can be changed, comes into play. So again, to give a small example, there is this huge discussion in particularly conservation sciences about how to keep the environment protected. You need to remove the indigenous people from the land because they have been continuously misusing the environment. But this is not true. These communities have been living with the environment for thousands and thousands of years and know exactly what they need to do to ensure that they live there. So then if there are certain people sitting in some big office saying, no, for us to have environmental justice, we need to remove these people because only then can the environment be sustained. And not going and talking to the people and seeing how they have been sustaining that region or that community for so many years, then that is again unjust. So then to have true justice, you need to ensure that all the people have a say in the table, all the people with their different understandings and their different ways of looking at the realities and their different ways of perceiving what is right and what is sustainable have proper say or are equally heard. Then you can think of a just world.
You've been mentioning terms like indigenous knowledge and there are also things that we use like ecological knowledge, lay knowledge, citizen science. How are they related to this topic of the decolonization of knowledge production?
So I think the reason why we use these different terms is again because of the colonization of knowledge. Because the reason why we use terms like indigenous knowledge or lay knowledge or citizen science is because we give predominance to knowledges which are produced in academic universities, you know? So then everything which comes with from within academic institutions becomes the true knowledge or the correct knowledge. And every other way of perceiving things and analyzing things and drawing conclusions becomes citizen science or lay knowledge or indigenous knowledge, but, you know, it's only there in that community but doesn't really talk to bigger, what we basically understand as bigger knowledge production or true knowledge. And this is a problem because if you think about it, when we started doing our research, one of the first things which was told, at least to me in the beginning of my PhD, was that your research topic or your research question should be something which would have broader applicability. And this again comes back to the coloniality of knowledge, is that you give these grand theories. So your knowledge, your academic knowledge is only valued if it fits everywhere. So often we see all these cases of these, of certain theories being given while we are sitting here in Vienna or in Barcelona or in Paris and saying, this theory explains everything which is happening to the world. And then you pick up some case studies from somewhere and saying, oh, but it doesn't work there because of so-and-so reason, and whatever works there cannot be universalized because this doesn't come from academia, you know? And this is the problem. And also now when we were talking about the decolonization is not a metaphor, it's just this, it is kind of a continuation of the same problem because indigenous knowledge in some way also always continues to be geographically focused. So when we need to break colonization of knowledge, we need to say that the knowledges that have been produced or these grand theories that have been made are not universal. And this kind of breaks the first assumption of academic knowledge production, that how can you give a theory which is not universal? But with more and more examples and with more and more real life cases that we are seeing, is that it is not universal. And we need to accept that, that knowledges are produced with communities, with the places where you are living in. So, of course, what is true and what works in Vienna will, for example, not work in my state in Jharkhand, in India, you know, and it shouldn't be working. So why this need to have this one idea, this one grand theory, and everything else which happens from everywhere else comes up as lay knowledge, citizen science, indigenous knowledge? So I think this is, again, this hierarchy that certain knowledge systems have over other, and this is what we need to break if we want to decolonize the knowledge systems.
Yes, even in Hungary, we sometimes, even as academics, we sometimes mention the term painfully local, because whenever we submit a paper and we know it's about Hungary or a Hungarian case, we know that's the reaction of academic journals, that, you know, this is just painfully local and nobody's interest. So even within Europe, there is this kind of attitude. Let's have a look at the potential solutions, because now we kind of, I'm sure there are more depth to this topic, but we can roughly see the problems. Where do you think the potential solutions lie? And let's first focus on the global scale. How would you change the global knowledge production systems to kind of move towards decolonization?
So this is a big question, huh? I have been trying to think and engage a little bit. I think the way to do that, of course, so we're talking about the global scale. And I think the first thing that we need to do is change it from where the systems were created. So there is more responsibility for universities here than in the rest of the majority world, you know? So for us to go to our classrooms, to go to our textbooks and go to our theories and see critically where and how was this knowledge produced. And also, and this comes from more this idea of post-normal science, that everything is politics laden. You know, there is no objective science. Whoever is writing whatever has some biases with which they are writing. Their positionality affects how they see the world and how they draw conclusions. To then claim that certain sciences are totally objective and the others are not is like the first thing that we need to question. And once we question that, then, especially, you know, considering ecological economics, we work more on sustainability and issues of social and ecological justice, we need to ensure that this becomes a two-way dialogue. So this idea of action research theory or this idea of co-production of knowledge, which again cannot fall back in the old trap of like co-production of knowledge doesn't mean you go to the community, you talk to a few people, you take all the insights that they give, and then you try to situate it within this grand theory that you've learned from before. So the way to decolonize it would be then to talk with the community and see what are the different ways in which different methodologies can be drawn, different analysis can be done, and doing it together and kind of, and it's hard work, but kind of putting aside the theories that you've been taught for many, many years and trying to see things from new perspective and trying to find solutions together. I think this would be the first step to start to do real decolonization of knowledge production.
So you've mentioned certain methodologies like action research, but still, I somehow have the feeling, and I really struggle with this, maybe you can help me get over this somehow, but there's like a massive history behind this. So basically, when we're talking about decolonizing knowledge, we're talking about an unjust system that is there, and the traces of that unjust system is still there. So when we are talking about co-creation, it is actually the people who are co-creating with us. They have never been in that situation before. And just the way we kind of try to co-create, that's already an imbalanced situation. So how can you, is there any way to kind of right previous wrongs and use methodologies where the way you're setting the scene is just, mm-hmm. and is just in terms of historical justice as well?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's impossible, but it's definitely an uphill battle. I can think of one example of this idea of critical cartography. So basically, there have been many groups, the few that I know are from Latin America, and they say that the way in which maps were drawn, or the way in which you understand geographies or locations or what is there in a region, is very different if you go and talk to people who have been in those regions. I know of this one collective from New Mexico, one of the states in US, where indigenous communities have been coming together and saying that the way in which Google Maps shows this territory is not something that we see it ourselves. So they have been making different maps, different ways of imagining things, like, and they say that it's not just your GIS or your plain topography. There are so much history in the river, in the mountains, in the rocks, in the forest. And then we need to bring those up when we are trying to make a map. And they have been working together with like different people from the community to bring up these different maps and saying, this is how we see ourselves, and this is how we want to portray our land, our region. So this is one example of critical cartography. Then there are other examples of critical cartography, this from Mexico, where they have been saying that the way in which state maps or government maps demark certain areas as wasteland or as unfertile land, which then they can appropriate for extractive industries, is not right. So we are going to go into this land and with our collective knowledge say, no, this is not wasteland. You know, here we have two crops. Here the animals come and graze. You cannot just say this is wasteland because we have been using this land. So then bringing up different perspective. So they are creating it themselves with maybe some help from certain other people who consider themselves researchers or activist scholars, and bringing in together different perspectives. So, yeah, I mean, I completely get your point of when we are trying to co-create knowledge, if the people within academia still come with the baggage of academia, then it's a problem. But increasingly, there are more and more people who are still, although within academic spaces, have one foot outside. You know, they know what is the problem and they want to find solutions. And in that sense, to kind of use the power which academia gives us. For example, the fact that you have access to so many, like institutional access to so many books and journals and other kinds of reports, which is not possible without these institutional accesses, can be then utilized in certain ways in this co-creation process.
And what about encouraging actors to trust their knowledge and resist devaluing their thoughts in the process and really believe that their contribution to change is just as meaningful? Because I believe that's also a problem.
True. Yeah, I completely agree with you. So to give you an example from India, there are these schools which come up very close to indigenous territory, which have this mandate of telling the new generation or the younger kids that everything that your parents and your grandparents are telling you is wrong, you know, and we in the school will tell you what is the right way of looking at things and understanding things. So there is this big mechanism which works even today to devalue a particular way of life, particular way of understanding things. So this is a much harder battle than just going and telling them to value their knowledge, because there is this whole mechanism which is telling them and their kids that everything that you're doing is wrong. In India, you still have, even in government reports, even today, you still have phrases like their savage ways and their savage lives. But not to go too far, the thing which happened, I think, a couple of weeks ago, this jungle and garden metaphor. So yeah, there is still this very dominant narrative of what is happening in the rest of the world is, and the way they are living is not the civilized, is not the proper way of doing things. So then to go and to find ways to let people know, or to not let them forget that there is so much worth and so much value in the way they perceive things, in the way they look at solutions, in the way they understand the world, in the way they understand relationships, is, I think, very, very vital and needs to be also at the forefront of decolonizing the knowledge systems. Yeah.
Yes, and I completely agree that basically the way we tend to see ecological economics and basically our transitions to a different kind of world is through trying many, many, many different solutions. And to try all these solutions and to really take these solutions seriously, we have to lose the judgments. And this happens all the time. We're judging people. We're judging other ideas. We're judging other trends and movements. And I think it's quite crucial for us to understand that, first of all, we have to stop judging ourselves, so that and anybody's idea is just as worthy, and then stop judging streams of thoughts and say that they can all contribute. At least this is how I see. And in that kind of approach, this topic that you're talking about is really important, because I think that's the clue that we're judging, and schools are judging the grandparents' way of life. And what do you think about that?
So this judgment doesn't come just like that, you know, and this is the thing which is important to remember, that there is all these advertisements and there is all these external influences which tell you to judge. To give a very personal example, when I was growing up, it was kind of assumed that if you don't speak English, then you're no good, you know, and people who were speaking bad English were not smart people or were not intelligent people or didn't have anything worth saying just because of a language. And this is the power that English has in India, for example. And for many, many years, it was taught to me in school, like we were asked to pay fines if we were caught speaking in our mother tongue in schools, you know, from when we were 5 years old. So this is how strong this. So then when you go home and your parents cannot, or your grandparents cannot speak English, can only speak the local language, you don't want to engage with them. You don't want to talk to them about the local books, the local knowledges, the local histories, because you are fascinated, or you have been taught to be fascinated by what has been written in English literature, you know? So you completely, and I did it for many years, I would not read things written in my literature, in my language. And this is because of this push for, you need English to prosper. You know, you need to have good English. That's the only thing you need. And this is a very small example. And this is also coming from my positionality as like a middle class, upper caste woman. So imagine what it must feel like for indigenous communities. At least like my language, Bengali, is like it has huge literature. Like it is a very culturally diverse language, you know. You've had people getting Nobel Prize in literature in my language, so it's not that bad. Even then, it was for me for many years, I didn't even look at the language. And then slowly I came to know, but why am I doing this? Why was this taught to me? Why was a language given so much importance over knowledge? And this is a very small example, but it magnifies enormously the more and more you go and look at more and more examples. So I think there is this whole mechanism which tries to still force certain forms of knowledges over others, certain languages over others, certain textbooks over others, certain subjects over others. And we need to actively try to dismantle it. What you were talking about, also the disciplinary boundaries, no, of not judging somebody who also maybe did not go to a university, but has so much knowledge because has been a part of a local movement against an extractive industry, has so much knowledge because has been going to courts every other day, has been filing public litigations, but doesn't have a law degree, you know? So the more and more you go and talk and engage with these people, you realize a university degree does not necessarily mean that you have more knowledge than others, or being able to speak English or any other colonial language doesn't mean you have more knowledge than others. So these would be things we would need to break and dismantle before we remove these value judgments. I think it's a very hard task, but it can be done. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. And last, I would like to ask you the question I ask all my guests. What is your rebellion?
My rebellion is to try to transform classes. This is what I'm doing right now. So to be critical and to allow others in my class to be critical of what we are studying and why we are studying them, and trying to make more and as many people as I can be aware that everything which has been published doesn't mean that they are all correct, you know, so to question that and to see why are we reading, for example, a paper on Zimbabwe with no Zimbabwean authors cited in the reference, and to try to open the eyes of and make people see the coloniality of knowledge around us. This is like the small rebellion that I'm doing right now.
A small but important, very important rebellion. Thank you so much, Rototi, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Rototi.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.